book, The Politics of Jesus, published in 2006. I personally think it's the finest religious book to have come out so far in this century.
In 1990, House Whip Newt Gingrich hired professional pollsters to produce what commentator Bruce Miller calls a lexicon of demonization. Gingrich circulated the results of the poll in a memo entitled Language, the Key Mechanism of Control. The memo instructed conservative politicians to describe liberals as often as possible by using pejorative words and phrases, including sick, pathetic, traitors, anti-flag, anti-jobs, anti-family, corrupt, selfish, cheat, steal, criminal rights, permissive attitudes, pessimistic, and radical. Ann Coulter, a darling of the right, has made a cottage industry of demonizing liberalism. Even terrorists don't hate America the way liberals do. Sean Hannity equates liberalism with wickedness without you ever having to open his 2004 book, Deliver Us from Evil, Defeating Terrorism, Despotism, and Liberalism. Journalist Michael Savage shows eagerness for his own ideas to be similar by the title of his book, Liberalism is a Mental Disorder. Not only do conservatives paint the political philosophy of liberalism as a product of insanity, they actually characterize it as the creation of the devil. Reverend Jerry Falwell has declared, "Our battle is with Satan himself." Today's conservatives, most of whom claim to be Christians of some sort, seem to ignore some of Jesus' most important pronouncements, such as, love your enemies. By this, Jesus did not mean to give enemies free rein to wreak havoc or cause harm. He was referring to the disposition of one's heart, the importance of keeping track of one's own humanity, as Cornel West puts it.
The second reading is a wonderfully clear and spiritual poem by the late Polish poet Anna Swier. It's called, I Do Not Accept.
I do not accept. I renounce this fingernail already worn by my grandfather, this head occupied for 2,000 years by the bloody body of Julius Caesar. The dead sit on me like a mountain. The carrion of barbaric epics, of bodies and thoughts decay in me. Cruel corpses of centuries ask that I be as cruel as they. But I am not going to repeat their dead words. I have to give myself a new birth. I have to give birth to a new time.
Cruel corpses of centuries, writes Anna Swier, ask that I be as cruel as they, but I'm not going to repeat their dead words. I have to give myself a new birth. I have to give birth to a new time. Those are beautiful lines to me, clear and concise. Anna Swier uses a phrase often associated with evangelical Christianity, a new birth. I have to give myself a new birth, she says. It sounds a lot like born again to me. But Swier is not writing as an evangelical or even a Christian. She is using the metaphor of new birth in a very different way. She is not turning from her own personal sins, but from the cruelties of an entire culture in which she has been raised. She speaks of Caesar's assassinated corpse inside her head, bloody and dead. the carrion of the centuries, the decay of the ages, the human violence of 10,000 years. Onosphere wants to be born again, thrust out of that history, that culture, that system in which she was born. And yes, you and me too. Anyone who has learned history from grade school on up is filled to overflow with horrific images, with the trenches and stench of mustard gas, the billowing smoke rising above Auschwitz, the blazing desert oil wells, the rubble of cities, the wail of sirens, the verbal violence of propaganda and innuendo. Onosphere wants to be born into a new life where violent actions and language are not the norm, but where she can be free to be kind, loving, caring, supportive, cooperative, and tender as much as she wants. Guess what? I want to be born again, too, into that same world. But before I am born again into a world where violent action and language is not the norm, I have to be born again in myself. I have to renounce the world of violent language and action in me. After all, like most of us in this room, I have been soaking it up like a sponge all of my life. From hearing this show Gunsmoke on the radio when I was a kid, bang, bang, to seeing very well-intentioned but still chilling films featuring violence like Schindler's List. And I have also seen what I would call more pornographic films about violence, like almost everything Governor Schwarzenegger ever did in his movie star days, and most late show horror movies involving the slashing of teenagers in some haunted house. The newspapers, the websites, the cable news shows, reports of violence and innuendos are simply everywhere. Like air. Aubrey Hendricks, in his magnificent book, The Politics of Jesus, points out that some of the violent and distorting language of our present era was actually planned and created deliberately by very real human persons. He names Newt Gingrich, for example, although this idea of nasty language seems like a cynical thing to work on, it was also perhaps strangely insightful about how people respond to such things. Because God knows the response from many liberals has been tit for tat, name for name, demonization for demonization. Sean Hannity, named by Reverend Hendricks as one of the blossoms grown from the seeds sown by Gingrich, now even has a section on his popular television show where political liberals call in and get to rant and rave and shout at him and denounce him personally for a few minutes, which they do with explosive invective that probably has Mr. Gingrich rocking back and forth with glee. Mr. Hannity just smiles and gives you that look. See? I told you all the liberals were crazy, didn't I? As a Christian professor at Union Seminary in New York City, Aubrey Hendricks distances himself from the also Christian Hannity's theological pronouncements about liberals by reminding us that Jesus' central teachings were entirely liberal. Yes, that Jesus, the Son of Mary, who was born in the Galilee 2 millennia ago, we know not where, and who died during the rule of the Roman prefect Pilatus in the year 30 or thereabouts. That liberal Jesus. No, of course, not liberal or progressive in the modern American political sense of that term. I am not telling you that Jesus has breakfast with President Obama every morning. That would be taking him out of time and place. But liberal in the basic meaning of that word, which is generous to one and all, egalitarian, compassionately just, and radically welcoming. Now, as you very well know, over the centuries since his death, people have made a big deal about Jesus. They have turned him into a god. They converted him into a philosophical abstraction, or a frightening judge to scare children with. They painted him as a blonde in a bathrobe and hung the picture in church parlors. Or more recently, among a small circle of skeptics, they have denied he ever lived at all, assuming he was simply the god of wheat dressed up by cunning storytellers, or simply a fairy tale invented by way too clever profiteers. Now, as I have made clear over and over again, none of these options are supported by peer-reviewed critical methods, which I have always found most trustworthy in uncovering historical reality as best we can. And today I lift up the general consensus of modern critical historians that although we can't say much about Jesus for sure, like where he was born or what he looked like or anything like that, and although more than half of the words attributed to him come from later minds and later rhetorical generations, there is little question that there was an historical man at the core of all the reports who actually said, albeit in his own language, "Love your enemies." Christian commentary, sadly, on that ancient proclamation is the history of avoidance and squirming, with very few exceptions. Part of the squirming, of course, has to do with the word enemy itself, which is hardly a soft and easy word. But love is the word that really gets in the way. How could anyone find any love in their heart for a brutal family member, a monstrous political tyrant, fill in the blank, or any oppressive religious leader? But those words don't say anything about love in the sense of feeling, love of the romantic or appreciative or even worshipful kind. The text simply uses the Greek verb agapao, which means to love with the mind rather than with the heart or the body. It means to decide on love, not to fall in love or to warm up to someone. Furthermore, to love one's enemies does not refer to family brutes in the first place. No, the whole context of those words is clearly set in a discussion of how to respond to the occupying army of Rome. And it doesn't involve feeling cuddly toward a centurion either, or your abusive father. It involves refusing to forget the essential, if damaged, humanity of that centurion or your abusive father. What does that mean? It means to remember that those who oppress are also themselves caught up in their own web of oppression that tightens on their necks as well, and that they can be reminded of that. When you love your enemy, you never forget or deny the violence of your oppressor. On the contrary, you name it loud enough for them to hear. But you invite them by your actions, note, not by your feelings, to understand what they are doing to you in a new way. Jesus gave many examples himself, both hair-raising and humorous, but let's go away from the Gospels and use a modern example instead. Let's even cross the ocean. After all, faraway examples always seem to be easier to take than things closer to home. This story comes from Walter Wink, a brilliant liberal Christian theologian, and it takes place in South Africa during the days of apartheid, when whites ruled and blacks suffered. Picture a city street. Use your imagination, even if you have never been to Cape Town or Johannesburg. Picture a city street and a sidewalk along that street. A black woman, about 35, is walking down the street with her three children, ranging in age from, say, 5 to 10. An older white man, his face distorted with his own inner bile, walks past the woman and spits into her face. She looks at him, smiles, and says, "Why, thank you. And now, for the children." Suddenly made conscious of what he has done, his conscience suddenly alive, perhaps for the first time in years, the white man's face falls and droops. He darts across the street and tries to get away from the painful self-reflection on his experience with the woman and her children. But I assure you, he will not be able to run away from it. It will shadow him all the rest of his days and all of his sleepless nights. By saying what she said, she loved her enemy. She did not imagine him to be beyond hope or worthy of immediate crucifixion, but rather she invited his heart to open up to what he actually was doing. His act was undeniably despicable, but she still regarded him as human as herself. And her act serves to clarify the meaning of loving one's enemy. To love one's enemy is to affirm that the human race is not divided into two and only two categories, the indescribably good and the monstrously evil. To love one's enemy is to affirm that we either all work together despite the suffering visited upon some humans by other humans, or we don't have the slightest chance of surviving at all till the next century. It's to realize with honest fear that in order to survive, we have to be deliberately born again as human beings who refuse to continue to do what our ancestors did before us. Cruel corpses of centuries, she writes, ask that I be as cruel as they, but I am not going to repeat their dead words. You see, loving enemies is a decision, not a romance. I am not going to repeat, Sveer insists. Even if she feels like she wants to, the feeling is going to be there. Do you not think I want to kick in the television screen when Sean Hannity's face appears? I do, but that's not the point. I don't do it. I decide not to do it. Now, the story of the woman in South Africa is a very dramatic example. I'll give you that. And the children's story we heard this morning was a very playful reminder that many people who irritate us are not really our bitter enemies in the first place. We may just misunderstand their motivations, their context, their approach, and over time, we will come to love them with warm feelings and everything. So I want to offer you an example somewhere between these two poles that might be helpful. Before the recent presidential inauguration, I read and heard, as many of you did, all of the complaints that Pastor Rich Warren was going to offer the invocation at that amazing event. Most of the upset came from a community that I suppose I must be part of, the so-called gay community. But unlike many vocal protesters, and even though I am in no way an evangelical Christian or a Christian at all in any ordinary meaning of that term, I myself was actually moved by Senator Obama's leadership in asking Pastor Warren to pray. Now, the issue as to whether there should be prayers at all at such a function is not on my mind today, although I think if anyone is waiting around for that to change before another century passes, you may have to learn to live with some disappointment. President-elect Obama knew that this country is made up of people of all kinds, including people like Warren, with distorted and disastrous understandings of people like me. But this guy is not going to just wake up one morning and suddenly be a pro-GLBT secularist, picketing his church, writing him excoriating letters, chiding him for his prejudicial biblical interpretations will certainly make me feel good. But it's hardly appealing to his humanity. And he is, I beg to tell you, a human being, like me, like you. To categorize him as the devil himself, as a monster, is to merely take a page from his book and to fling it back at him. It's to divide the world up between the saved and the damned, the right and the wrong, the righteous and the evil, the us and the them, the either and the or. Did he say cruel things during the Prop 8 campaign in California? Oh, yes, he did. Does he proclaim things I find baffling and outside the realm of what I myself would call moral, namely the blood atonement of Christ, the existence of hellfire, and so forth? Absolutely yes. Do I think he has spoken from both sides of his mouth at times? Yes, I do. And is he a human being, a citizen of the nation I claim as my own, also a citizen, I also who am a human being? Yes. Vilifying him will not change him. But inviting him to pray in front of the world, in front of, quite literally, because of the media, billions of people, as President-elect Obama did, appealed to his very real humanity. And Pastor Warren, strange to tell, rose to the occasion in a country where many televised conservative evangelical mouths, Mr. Robertson, Mr. Hagee, and so forth, excoriate Islam on a daily basis. Check this out yourself if you don't believe me. Warren quoted from the Quran several times, and beautifully so. In a world where the president of the Southern Baptist Convention once famously said, "God does not hear the prayer of a Jew," Warren quoted the entire Shema, the foundational Jewish prayer text. And in the middle of his prayer, when he was using his own language, he said, "When we focus on ourselves, when we fight each other, forgive us. We are united not by religion," that is, this is not a Christian nation, "but by our commitment to freedom and justice for all. Help us to share, to serve, and seek the common good for all." And at the end, he didn't pray in the name of Jesus Christ our Lord, co-opting all listeners as if they were part of some Christian nation. No, he spoke only of his own personal experience, which he did not foist off onto anyone else. Pastor Warren spoke the downright liberal words I just quoted. They are everywhere on the internet. He cannot take them back. Freedom and justice for all. Seek the common good for all. These are progressive words, inclusive words, expressions of what Aubrey Hendricks would call, with acclaim, liberalism. Admittedly, I would have prayed a much different kind of prayer had I been asked. I do not share theology with Pastor Warren at most accounts. But so what? He rose to the occasion from within his own tradition, stretching it to be as inclusive as possible, as the president-elect suspected he would. President Obama, you see, is a sort of liberal Christian himself. He disagrees with Warren on many things, which he has said to his face, including quite pointedly Roe versus Wade. But he knows that he has to be a president of a nation that includes folks like Warren by the tens of millions. And if the conservatives were to kill off all of these nasty liberals they excoriate, and the liberals were to kill off all the conservatives that make them blow steam out of their ears, we would end up with a whole nation of righteous but extremely dead corpses. Dead as Caesar with knife wounds all over his body, dead as Jesus with nail wounds in his body, dead as healing women and heretics burned down to white ash, dead as 1,000,000,000 slaves. Warren is not Obama's enemy at the level of that South African woman's white oppressor, I admit that. But their disagreements are real and they are powerful. And there is no question that Pastor Warren used oppressive language in California. But Mr. Obama chose to decide to act in a loving way, even to a man who, although good in many ways, has really hurt my brothers and my sisters. By doing so, Senator and now President Obama, I think, demonstrated a far greater respect for the teachings of Jesus than Warren did in California. But in asking him to pray, he appealed to a humanity deeper than his religion, and Warren rose to the occasion. I am not so cynical as to think it was a calculated politics-as-usual show choice. I think it was a principled decision based on the teachings of Jesus that are in his heart, and for that matter, in the heart of gay Quaker Bayard Rustin, and Baptist Martin Luther King Jr., and Hindu Mahatma Gandhi, and Catholic humanist Danilo Dolci, and Muslim Badshah Khan, and Maori Te Whiti, the mother circling around the plaza in Argentina, and the Unitarians and Universalists Noah Worcester, Lydia Marie Child, Mary Ovington, John Haynes Holmes, and Aidan Ballou. That's real leadership, by the way. Taking that kind of risk, willing to bear the results, whatever. And I applaud the president for it publicly now. But Anna Svir is right. To continue to use the violent language of our dead ancestors is to perpetuate their bloodshed all over again. To call those who despise us as devils the same names back. is only to mirror and imitate their tragic games. To name their cruelty plainly, to resist it, to find ways to call them to account, but to refuse to demean them or to be violent toward them, that is to be born anew and to recognize that all of us, every single one of us, in this room and outside of it, to the ends of the earth, are all equal in the eyes of love.